This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Sanebox, where inbox zero is just one click away.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of The Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Markets snap back. OPEC sends cuts and the Fed sends a dovish message. Frank Curzio from Curzio Research is our guest. Lots to talk about this and so much more on episode number 511 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello, Andrew Horowitz here, the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, and I'm glad you're with me. Hopefully you're having a good Memorial Day weekend, enjoying some sun and fun and family and friends and just a good time overall. It's the beginning of summer, so we have that to deal with markets when you usually see a little bit of lower volatility overall and sometimes actually not so much lower volatility, but lower volume and actually an increase in volatility. Misspoke there a little bit, but we'll see what happens because volatility has been shrinking dramatically. The VIX under 10 again, just for a brief little bit last week after it spiked more than the $15 level in the previous week. So a very significant amount of movement overall with that move about 50% up and then a 50% down. So pretty impressive overall. I wanted to talk about a few things before we get to our guest, Frank Curzio. I had some questions that were sent in from some listeners. If you do want to ask questions, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Click on the Ask Andrew button on the top there and you can just ask away. Let me see what I'm going to get to. A few of these here, just very quickly, because I have a lot of questions to ask Frank. Robert Smiley asked me, he says, as a beginning investor, I would like to have short sales explained in detail and how to execute this kind of trade. A lot of you probably have this question. How much money do I have to put up? How long does a short sale exist, etc.? So what I'm going to do now is I want you for a moment, everybody for a moment, forget what you know about investing just for a second, just for a wee second. And I want you to think about just what I'm going to tell you here. And that is this. Think about when you buy a stock. When you buy a stock, you buy it at a price and you want it to go higher. And then you sell it at a higher price and then you make a profit. So you buy, let's say at a dollar, you sell at $2 and you make that profit. That's easy enough for everybody to understand, right? Okay. Well, let's just say that a short sale is exactly the opposite. Now, don't think anything more than what I'm about to tell you here. You sell it at $2 like we did before, but you do that first and you buy it back at a dollar. Again, the same thing. So therefore, the transaction is simply the same as you did before, but in reverse. So in a regular transaction, you buy, let's say, at a dollar and you want to sell at $2. You make the dollar profit. In a short sale, the same two components of the transaction exist, where you will have a buy and a sell. It's all about when it happens. Now, in order to do a short sale, you have to sell first. And you say, well, all right, now it's getting complicated. Now you're saying I got to sell first. I don't have it. How do I sell something I don't have? I don't understand. Well, let's just say that there's a button on your broker that says sell short. And when you sell short, and you get executed, like we just talked about, at $2. When the time comes, instead of saying buy, it's buy to cover. Cover the short. A little bit of a different terminology. So basically, this again, the transaction is the same. You buy and you sell, and hopefully your buy is lower than your sell. A short sale just happens in reverse, and what happens behind the scenes, don't worry about. Don't worry about how the broker goes out and borrows shares and hypothecates someone else's position and brings it over. If the short shares are available and your account is available to do so, IRAs are not, for example. But if you have an account that has margin and you have the availability to actually transact short positions, what happens is you go out and you click the button and you say short these shares. So you short 100 shares at $2. And then when it gets to your price, let's say back to a dollar, well, you made that dollar profit. Now, what happens with a short sale that's different than when you're buying on a long side is that you have unlimited loss potential. And you have a finite potential for gain because the stock price is not going to go below zero. So if you bought that share in a long transaction at a dollar and it goes to zero, you lost a dollar. It can't go to negative $5. In a short transaction, you start losing money as the share price goes higher. And what is the top price that you can have for a share price in the future? It's unlimited. So therefore, when you look at a short sale, you have to look at the fact that there is a finite level of gain and an unlimited loss potential. That's why it's a bit more risky. But again, just executing it, you can hold it forever. You can hold the short forever and ever and ever, as long as you don't get a margin call on your account if it goes well away from you. There's a question again from Gabe, and he says, what is with this ETF DRIP? It's a leveraged oil short. I've talked about this before. There are some leveraged ETFs that work out well. I think we talked about the four-time up and down last week that's coming on the market. And there are some of these that actually work well, Gabe. Some of these don't. The ones that don't work well usually are related to commodities because of the future roles that are involved. So this is probably the situation you're having here. And if you don't understand how it works, don't invest in it. Stay away from it. Anonymous Dude, thanks for your name there, Anonymous Dude, asked a question related to leveraged ETFs. And he says, what happens if both I short the up and the down? We know that there's usually degradation of these leveraged ETFs. And as you go from 2 times to 3 times and now 4 times, and that's the symbols for the 4 times leveraged ETFs for the S&P 500. Well, I don't know what's going to happen because these may not degrade as much as you would for things like the VIX or oil or other commodities related. And that's probably why it was approved, because I don't think they would be approving a 4 times multiple, let's say VIX, who knows, maybe they will, but a 4 times multiple VIX ETF, because it's probably going to be a short right off the block, kind of the back up the truck kind of short. So I'm not sure what will happen here. It may be a good idea. I would track it for a while and see what happens after it comes out, after it has a track record, after you could see and do a little bit of analysis on this. But I wouldn't get too carried away. We had a couple more here, but I want to leave it at that. We'll get to our next show. Again, just go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and you can check out exactly how to submit a question. It's very easy. Just go over to the little button there. And you could simply just ask a question and we'll do our best to answer it. What else did I want to talk? Oh, I know what I want to talk about before we get to Frank. Just very quickly, our advertiser and our host of this episode, SaneBox, because, you know, I got to tell you something. Sometimes email can get the best of you. Or sometimes the email marketers and the people that flood you with this, the spam can really hinder your day. You can have an email box that's getting crazy. Well, how do you keep control of that? There's a lot of little ways, but if you want a really good way, you got to check out SaneBox. SaneBox.com/TDI. You go there and basically you get this product. You're going to have a free trial of it. As a matter of fact, they'll even throw in a $20 credit if you use that particular address. You get a 2-week free trial and basically you're going to get an email inbox cleaner. They have a lot of different ways and functionality. It's really easy. It's not hard to check this out. I got to tell you, it's very easy to deal with. But they have some things like the black hole where you just move an email into that folder and you'll never see an email from that sender again. Plus, it keeps your email box clean so you could really focus on the things that are important to you. And the stuff that's not, you don't have to fumble through throughout the day. I highly encourage you to check this out at SaneBox.com/TDI. And our guest today is Frank Curzio, the one and the only from Curzio Research. You could find lots of information that's just fascinating to you as an investor and as a person by learning more about Frank. We'll get to that in a second. Frank, it's been a while. How you been?
I've been pretty good, man. How you doing?
I'm good. What's going on in your neck of the woods? You're in the northern part of Florida.
Not, you know what? It's starting to get a little bit hot here. You know, summer's coming around. I still can't get used to the kids' schedule, right? My daughter's schedule, where they, you know, used to be between Labor Day, Memorial Day, you know, for being in the East Coast. But in Florida, they you know, get out early. They go back to school like the beginning of August. I don't know. I'm still confused. I don't know.
It used to be the Jerry Lewis 2th telethon was the date that'll be like, oh, it's here. That means I got to go back to school the next day. You know, now it's, I think they get out in, like you said, late May. They try to follow the college schedule. I think that's what it's all about down here.
Yeah, they just got to get. I'm still getting adjusted to it, but what are you gonna do?
Well, a lot of things have happened since the last time we talked, and I got so many questions to go over with you. And but I guess let's tee it up with the discussion of oil. Oil's been on, I guess it's easy to say, it's been on a roller coaster ride for some time. As we see that there's a lot of talk out of OPEC and non-OPEC, and there's been an issue about inventory builds and demand questions and all of this, and hit down in the low 40s or the mid to low 40s a couple of weeks back. Goldman Sachs was pounding the table about, you got to buy it now, buy it now. They switched their whole positioning on it. And then we saw that OPEC, they're going to extend the cuts, and oil started to rally. What's your take on oil?
I'm bullish on oil, and I feel like I'm on an island by myself. I know Goldman came out with that report. I've been bullish on the recent downturn, and you know, I follow oil all my life. I actually visit every major shale area. You know, I've been to these areas, visited companies. In 2015, I actually had a presentation in front of 400 people, and I said, "How many of you own oil stocks?" And 95% of people raised their hand. And I told them, I said, "You should sell every single oil stock right now." And oil prices went from 90 to 60 when I said that, but a lot of companies didn't get hit because they had hedges on at higher prices. Mm-hmm. I knew those hedges were going to come off. There was going to be a flood of oil on the market. They would produce them like crazy because they had the hedges in place. And then the stocks fell tremendously. I'm not right all the time. That happened to be right, but I've been wrong sometimes too.
Well, let's interrupt. The reason the oil company stocks dropped wasn't just a normal decline in oil. It was not only a sharp decline, but a prolonged decline to where the hedging started to wear off, right?
The hedging wore off, and these companies were super leveraged. I mean, more leveraged than they've ever been in the history of the market. And that's what I think people didn't see, where they had a ton of debt due, that the economics didn't work. They weren't going to be able to produce at 50, and then it went to 40, 30 in the 20s, and these companies really got smoked. Today, if you look at these oil companies, they're in a lot better shape. They extended their maturities on their debt. Their balance sheets are much more stronger. They raised cash. But, you know, that's from the company perspective, which I think it's a buy now. But when you're looking at the fundamentals and you dig deep down into the numbers, I know, you know, when you look at the reporting, everybody watches CNBC and stuff like that, and they see this huge glut, and they have no – listen, everybody knows it's a glut, right? The whole world knows it, so it's factored into the price. But when you look at the glut and what happened, where most of that glut's coming out of the Permian. Again, this is an area I visited. There's four counties within that area where you can produce oil for lower than 35. Some companies can produce for lower than 30.
So tell people what the actual geographic location is of this.
Mostly Midland Basin. So if you're in Midland, I think it's Glasscock.
Stretch out a little bit. What state?
It's basically Texas. So the Permian and Eagle Ford are both located in Texas. The Permian's more in center west, central, and the Eagle Ford is more going across the whole entire southern area, from Mexico into, you know, it's huge at the Eagle Ford. So when you're looking at the Permian, it's became one of the best areas. And right now they're producing like crazy, seeing the rig count go up tremendously. So there's a lot of production coming online. However, what we just saw, when oil prices go lower, say to even the $45 level, what you see is production significantly tails off in the other two biggest unconventional regions. Where are they? That's one of the ones we just mentioned is Eagle Ford. The other is Nabok in North Dakota, which I also visited. They can't really produce. Some of them can, and certain areas can. Most can't produce.
And that's because, again,
The
economics, it is too expensive to raise the oil, and then they don't sell it for a profit. So what's the point of raising it?
Exactly. And evidence to this is the rig count, right? Because just we saw the rig count over the past few weeks. We're looking at the Eagle Ford and the Bakken are not adding rigs. The Permian's adding a ton of rigs. So we know when oil prices do fall, yes, the Permian can still produce and people are maxed out. You're seeing the biggest companies in the world go crazy in the Permian right now, and I get it. But when you look at the numbers, the Permian accounts for about 2.5% of worldwide consumption. So the EIA says we're going to basically demand's going to get up to 100 million barrels of oil per day, and we're producing around 2 million right now, near record highs again in the Permian. And that's worldwide. So you're looking at a small percentage, and when oil prices do come down, you're seeing, yes, you can still see oil being produced in the Permian, but you're not going to be seeing it in the other areas. And that's why we saw oil prices pop up right away, and the rig counts aren't being added to those areas if we fall below pretty much 43, 42 around there. So if we do see oil come down to 35, 30, which we could see, right? We could definitely see it. It's probably going to do the same thing it did last time where it was just a four-month period where it fell into the 20s and came back immediately back up to the 50s. So when you're looking at
I'm interrupting again. I apologize.
No,
but it's a natural supply and a natural balance, supply and demand as they call it. But it's a natural balance that if oil gets to a certain price – well, production on the downside is going to halt. If it gets to a certain price on the upside also, more rigs will be added in various areas where it is profitable to do so. And that could also have an equalizing effect on the total amount of production. Both sides, right?
Both sides, which is why I think we're going to be kind of in a trading range between 50 and 60. We could go lower. Again, we're just at 50 right now. We're going into it and... Yeah, there was rumors, we're talking about 3 weeks ago, that maybe OPEC may not cut. And now that they cut, we saw that, they just extended their cuts till March, that, it was more like a sell-off on the news and we're still above 50. But if you're looking at OPEC, which is very interesting, where in 2014, OPEC tried to be, these tough guys and, oil prices were at $95, they're averaging over 95 for about 3-4 years at the time. And they met, I believe, in September, October, and they were supposed to cut production. Well, OPEC tried to do something different and said, we're not going to cut production, and surprised the market and said, we're removing our quotas. So they allowed every nation in OPEC, I think it's 13 of them, to produce as much oil as they wanted, right? So they thought they were smart. They're like, let's make as much money as we can. And what happened is we saw the European economies, China slow, and these guys increased production. You have no idea. They were increasing production by 10, 15% a month, right? So you had this mess. So if you look to the date in 2014, it happened to be an absolute high. It was one of the biggest losses in the history that I've ever seen of the markets. I mean, even more than the credit crisis. There's studies on this that show that OPEC, because of this decision, and oil prices just crashed for the next year and a half all the way through 2016, they lost over $2 trillion because they decided to increase instead of cut their production numbers.
But they didn't finish it off. They didn't go to the extent. It's like a tennis player playing hard, just absolutely obliterating their opponent, then all of a sudden sitting back and feeling good about it, and the opponent saying, well, wait a minute, maybe there's an opening. They didn't finish it off. They didn't bankrupt as many companies as they could have to try to take back some of the production for themselves and to have, they caved too early, don't you think?
Yeah, and that's the thing. They wanted to basically get that market share back. They knew the U.S. could produce over $75 for unconventional wells. It's a lot cheaper now. The technology's gotten better. But we're talking 2014. They had no idea oil prices would fall. They had no idea demand would collapse in emerging markets and everything, and even some developed nations in Europe. And, they lost over $2 trillion in the process, where if you want to put that in perspective, Enron's loss was $60 billion, right? And we talk about that, like, oh, my God, it's case studies, but they lost $2 trillion. So to say that they were going into this meeting and they weren't going to maintain those cuts is insane. Now, after nine, I think the market's like, oh, we thought they were going to increase. They are going to increase those cuts depending on where the prices are. I think if they're in the 40s, come March, that they'll probably increase them. But they're smarter this time around. They understand. But the bottom line is, what you need to know as an oil investor is, it's very difficult to produce oil for under $35. And when we saw that, we've seen the rig count come, they're not adding rigs in most of the areas outside of the Permian. The Permian's getting the most attention. But we really can't produce that much oil. So if prices do fall below that, it's going to be a big buying opportunity. They're probably going to go back up to 50, 55. And like you said, on the other end, that brings in more production. And maybe we go to 60, 65 and overshoot and come back down. But I think it's going to be a nice trading range. And Andrew, with that trading range, it puts a lot of great oil companies in play that restructured their balance sheets. They're operating in the right areas. They sold off the non-core assets. Remember, when you go through these, like the internet crash, when you go through the credit crisis, the companies that survive are usually 10 times stronger going forward.
Because they either bought up their competition or they figured out a way to short. I mean, listen, if a company can come out the other side on this and they extend their maturities and they possibly discharge some debt, this is what's beautiful about the fixed income market, right? You can get rid of it. You can't get rid of your stock because you go bankrupt. But you can get rid of fixed income. You can restructure it. You could lengthen it. You could reduce down the actual cost of your debt financing because you're maybe reducing it down because they don't want to, the bondholders don't want to lose all their money. They're like, all right, I'll take a haircut. And when you come out the other side, and if in fact on the other side there is still profitability, then there is the opportunity to have that flow right down to the bottom line and make you really look pretty good. Would you agree with that?
The companies can even put hedges on, right? Because what do you really want to hedge production at $50? I mean, it could be like a world event. It could be a war that could push prices to 70, 80, and you hedge most of your production at 50. So they're not really hedging here. So, which means that if prices go lower, it's going to be very difficult for them to continue to produce, based on the economics, which that wasn't the case in 2015 because they had hedges in place. Oil was at 60. The hedges were locked in at 80, 85. So they're producing as much oil as they possibly can at 80, 85. So, when you're looking at this market today, I think it's a great opportunity to pick away at some oil companies.
Okay, let me ask you. So who is that? What sector? Is it the refiners? Is it the drillers? Who is it?
No, I wouldn't go with refiners. I like, an oil service company. I mean, of course you can go with the big guys. I like Superior Energy Services. They're one of they probably rank number five behind, the Weatherfords, Baker Hughes, you have
Halliburton,
Schlumberger. So, and the company just gotten beat up, and is a major disconnect between the stock price and the valuation of it. So much so where if you're looking at target prices are like 70-80% higher. I mean, just based on the value, they have no debt concerns at all, no major payments due for a while. So, you'll look and people will see it and say, wow, this company has a $1.7 billion market cap. And, they look at the debt and it's $1.3 billion. And they're like, holy cow, it's crazy. But when you really dig into the fundamentals, they restructure the debt. So a lot of that's not due for a long time. This is a company that's going to be generating like $1 billion in free cash flow going forward. They sold off the non-core assets. As long as you don't see oil prices going below 35, this company's going to be printing money. And I think you're getting it at a prime price right now. And that's just one of the companies that I kind of like. You want to invest. Real estate is key. That doesn't mean buy companies in the Permian because there's only about four counties within the Midland Basin that really can produce. I think Chevron just came out, if I'm not mistaken. It might have been Shell that came out and said, we could produce oil for $20 a barrel in the Permian. That might be a couple of wells, but most people can't do that. But it's because they're operating in that specific area. So if you're going to look to buy companies, make sure they're in the right areas. The right areas aren't the Eagle Ford, the Permian, and the Bakken. You want to look within these areas because there's like 30 counties in the Eagle Ford where maybe five or six could produce under 45. So you want to make sure you have the right real estate and you want to look at the fundamentals. You want to make sure they have no debt payments due because we know oil price could be erratic and they're going to overshoot the downside and the upside. But you want to have these companies in place where, they don't have to worry about debt payments. They're going to continue to drill and they can make money at least, with oil at $35 a barrel that they could actually break even there. Because I don't see prices going lower than that or staying there for a long time.
Yeah, one of the things also is that there was a time when we talked about fracking and various areas in the U.S. that these companies would require somewhere around, I think it was about $70 a barrel. Remember that?
Yep.
Remember that whole discussion? It was $70 was this magic number that was like, if they can't keep $70 per barrel, these companies are going bankrupt. Now, back to what you said a few minutes ago about the companies that come out on the other side will do well. Well, because they figured out how, we can't make money at 70. We got to figure out a way to make money at 35. And therefore, if oil ever gets back to 70, unless they get sloppy, which happens, it's like the airlines, how they get sloppy over time, right? Mm-hmm. Well, then you have a great opportunity. So give me one other company. So we talk about Superior Energy, maybe Chevron. Who else?
I would say SM Energy is another good company that I looked at where they pushed out all their debts and everything, and that company has come off, and SM Energy is around $20. I want to say Goldman probably has like a $40 target on this stock. I mean, that's where you've seen – I've seen more disconnects in this market than I've ever seen based on valuation, meaning someone could come over and take these guys over easily for $28 and it'll be – accretive in the first month after they take them over. I mean, that's how cheap some of these companies are. So you're seeing the pullback. You're seeing, I think this is the last leg of the washout, but it's going to give you an opportunity. Again, it's volatile. It's crazy. But I know SM Energy has amazing property where they could produce oil at $35 a barrel. So they could be printing money here. They could be generating a lot of money. They don't have debt concerns either. They pushed out those debt concerns. And even the companies, I mean, there's hold ratings on this stock with $30 target prices, and it's 20.
And how to make 100% gain on this stock tomorrow? You want me to tell you how?
Go ahead.
The company just has to come out with an app. If the company comes out with some app, just any app, people are like, oh, I'm going to buy it. Yeah, I'm going to. And just say, you know, SM Energy. SM stands for social media. That's what it stands for.
Perfect.
Let's buy it. Let's buy it. Because really in this market right now, as we segue into this discussion about not only oil, which by the way, and the price of oil moving higher, if you think about this, will benefit the markets because if you look at what the expectations are for profitability of the oil sector, not the largest sector of the S&P 500 or the markets, the fact is that right now there's a lot of negativity on that. And some of it is reasonably put on because there is some problem still there. But if we can get to positive earnings here in the future, that adds to the earnings characteristic of the S&P 500, which will help the whole market in its entirety. But when we look at the markets right now, have you obviously noticed, talking about disconnects, that the large cap market has been outperforming once again, like it was in, I think, 2015, has been outperforming the small cap and pretty much everything else. In other words, about 10 to 15 stocks in the S&P 500 are basically carrying the entire index up. What does that mean?
It's true, right? I mean, you've seen the Apples go up, you see the Googles go up, but if you're looking at earnings as a whole, the most interesting thing to me, I thought was fascinating, this earnings season, one is, you know, we had near double-digit growth. We saw huge sales growth, the strongest growth we've seen since, I believe, 2011, third, mm-hmm. fourth quarter.
Right.
But what was amazing, which again, maybe everybody else knows except for me, is the strongest earnings came from the companies that have the most overseas exposure, which is weird because you look at Trump's policies and when Trump got elected and we saw that rally, we're like, anything that has full exposure to the U.S. are going to get tax breaks. So you're going to see, you know, infrastructure spending in America. But kind of this earnings season, if you look, it's like 2/3 of the growth is coming from companies that have overseas exposure where they're killing it right now, which tells you what? It tells you that it may be finally time, and I've heard this argument for 6 years and people have been wrong, to start looking internationally. You're seeing that change. You're seeing the PMIs go higher. You're seeing these economies, the GDP numbers, you know, go off their lows. And that's when you want to buy it, when things go from bad to less bad. Not when things are bad to good, because when they turn good, you usually miss most of that move. But it's less bad in Europe. It's less bad in China. And you're seeing a lot of these countries.
I would take China out of that discussion because China looks like it's getting better, better.
Again, we can debate that. I've seen statistics on both sides. Who knows if they're real? But you're right. You could take them out of it. And again, with China, again, I learned my lesson in China too. I actually went there, visited companies, and it turned out they weren't.
You know
real.
What the best thing about China is? Their food.
What?
Their food.
Yeah, the street food.
The
is
food.
Amazing.
The food. The you know what? Thank God for China. Thank God for China. Now, listen, the thing about international investing, everybody's been talking about this, that the valuation on a relative basis to the U.S. markets is much, it's really warped. And, when you look at the S&P 500, the Dow, you look at the NASDAQ, you look at the price earnings multiples, et cetera, you look at all the growth potential. Everybody that I've been seeing, all the mutual fund managers, and they come in, we talk to them because I want to talk to them about where should we be? What's Europe? Europe, international, Europe. Emerging markets are a little cold on due to some, you know, what's going on in Brazil and a few other things. But generally speaking, they're all over this whole European trade, which I still am questioning if it is an actual trade that is getting too crowded now, or if it's just an alternative to, okay, if I have to be in stocks anyway, because a lot of these mutual funds do and institutions have to have a certain allocation of stocks, where would I rather be? In something I'm seeing as overvalued, like the U.S. markets that have the large caps really disproportionately outperforming, or should I be in something where looks like that there's, you know, things have been kind of scrapped for a while here and there's an opportunity, and add to the fact that our Fed is going this way and they're going that way. So
yeah, and even for individual investors, right? I mean, when you look at international, it doesn't mean to take like 20-30% of your portfolio and throw them in a whole bunch of countries through an ETF. Remember, the U.S. companies, like 35% of their profits come from overseas. So you can get a lot of that exposure through U.S. companies. It's a lot easier to buy. It's, you know, you don't have to worry about the disconnects in the ETFs that you see as well. But it is interesting to see that these countries, you're seeing profits come out of them. You're seeing more money get pushed into them. For me, I've heard that too. I've heard for 6 years how bullish everyone is. For me right now, it's when I'm seeing the numbers, I'm seeing the earnings come in. It's the first time in a long time.
Yep. No, I hear you. I hear you. Keep on cutting out a little bit here and there, but hopefully you'll be back in a second after I finish this next question.
Where I'm really considering saying, hey, you know what? Now finally it's a pretty good, it's a base and I think we could invest in it.
I missed you a little bit there.
Sorry, yeah, bud.
That's all right. I missed you a little bit, but you kept talking. It's okay. I guess the thing that I really want to kind of also talk about, and it relates to what we're talking about right now in terms of valuations, is that our market here in the U.S. seems to be impervious to any bad news or any other things that can derail it for more than like 10 minutes. It's this, you know, this ADD market. It's like, okay, oh my God, things are bad. What happened? I don't remember. That was last week. You know, it's like, you know, time is counted in minutes now versus, you know, in the old days, you would see things progress over days and weeks. We saw a lot of things on the political front last week or so happen. Big market downside. Some people say it was because of volatility expiration. I'm having a hard time squaring that circle. But it seems like we have a very short time frame and the bullish investors are, or at least the bullishness of the market is really very much ingrained. And the question I have to you on this is this because there's so much excitement, so much of a bullish market, which is A? Is it because maybe there's an outlook that everybody's so excited about in terms of taxes and budgets and reform and regulatory issues, or a combination of these? Or C, is there a lot of the passive investing that is going on, which just puts blindly money into a market, quote unquote market, that is just kind of raising all ships?
I don't think it's a passive investing. I mean, if you look from a fundamental level, stocks are not crazy expensive. And people, when I say that, it's so funny because you get that, are you crazy? This, because they're so used to hearing that without looking at the fundamentals. We're trading at what, 17 and a half times earnings, and people talk about bubbles. The NASDAQ was trading at 44 times earnings when it crashed. It doesn't mean we're not going to come down. I'm just saying we're not in a bubble.
And you have to admit we're not cheap either, though.
No, we're not cheap. But you know what? Do we deserve that premium? Where is it? We usually trade around 15 times earnings, maybe 15 and a half. You go back historically, maybe about the past 20 years. Why do you have that premium? Why does Facebook trade at 50 times earning and go up 300%? Why does Tesla do the same? It's because they have the growth behind it. So if you have that growth, you deserve that premium. That's why the Amazon.com keep taking off, even though you're looking at a PE and saying, wow, it's so expensive. How can it do it? Because it's growing enormously. Well, we just came off an earnings season that's growing faster than the fastest pace in 3 years. We're looking at an economy that's still Goldilocks type, where it's not too hot, not too cold. I think that's the biggest risk to the markets is the Fed aggressively raising rates.
Well, because
I don't see inflation. I really don't see inflation out there. You could point to certain things, and I'll point to commodities. I'll point to certain. You know, there's so many things out there. Wage growth is stagnant. I don't see the massive runaway inflation because, you know, we're not getting these pro-growth policies. I don't want to get into the politics of, you know, pushing.
Yeah, please don't, because anytime you mention something, people start sending emails.
Yeah, so what I do want to say is that if we do get tax reforms, that's immediately going to change the landscape of stocks. I mean, you may say, well, it's just like a piece of paper, somebody's going to sign it. But you're looking, if you do the math behind this, I've done analysis, you're looking at a market where if we get just half of the tax breaks that he's expecting. We're not even talking about repatriation, bringing that money back overseas at $2.5 trillion. We're looking at stocks trading more like 16 times earnings, but yet they're growing very, very fast. So you have the you know, again, low interest rate policy. You have a lot of things in place. Doesn't mean we can't come down, but that's why I can continue to see those buy and a dips mentality because we're not super expensive. We are growing. And when you see these pullbacks, it just says, hey, you know what? We're still in really good shape over here. I don't see the Fed doing anything crazy.
I'm talking about pullbacks that last 5 minutes. You know what I'm saying?
They do last really quick. I mean, I would love to see. But I'll be honest with you, right? I mean, how many stocks would you buy, Andrew, right now if the market pulled back 10-15%? I'd be an aggressive buyer in so many different stocks.
But 10-15%. We're talking about markets coming down 1%, and people are like, oh, my God, this is a deal. I saw after that pullback, that 1.5% pullback last week, people on TV saying, this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to get in. I'm thinking, what are you talking about?
Yeah, look, you got to be careful of the headline. That's what the media is, right? I mean, I've been CNBC, I've made the rounds. I know you made the rounds. I've been, you know, whatever, Fox Business News, ABC. If I call them and tell them that oil's going 100, I'll be on TV tomorrow.
Okay, just to put that in perspective. I won't even do TV anymore.
I don't know if I would do it. I've been offered and I just haven't, you know, it's just there's too many analysts. I mean, my late dad, when he was on TV, there's like he was one of the guys, like one of 10 people, And now they have so many people on there. It's like they have one guy saying the market's going to go down 50%. And the next guy is like the market's going to go up 30%. I mean, what does that do to your viewership? I mean, you have two guys arguing with meaningless points. And I don't know. I've learned to ignore it. But I know that's really tough for the average investor because that's where they get most of their information, where they don't have access to the platforms we have to actually do the research.
Right. But by the way, just to go back on something, I just thought of this. When you talk about how a lot of the earnings that came from many of the companies that have a tremendous amount or maybe even a disproportional amount of earnings from and revenue from overseas. And that was with a rising dollar environment last quarter. Now we have the US dollar sinking. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's going to help them even further? I mean, it must.
It must help them further. But it's interesting because now we're seeing a couple of the... We used to see gold prices rise, right? I mean, gold has been getting killed because of the strength in the dollar.
No. Gold's up 8% this year.
Yeah, but I'm saying even gold stocks have not really participated. Yeah, in that
you rally. Know, there is a little. I've been in and out of the gold miners this year very successfully. Knock wood, okay.
Yeah, but I mean they're down.
But they're not doing really
after,
well. Yeah.
Yeah, if they came up now they're down. Of course, you know you.
Well, because there's another right. There's another game in town. You know what it's called? Bitcoin. Bitcoin. It looks like it's going to $3,000.
I know. Bitcoin's insane. I know someone who bought Bitcoin at $7 and sold it at $70 and made $1 million. Our average guy.
Oh, and he must be really miserable now.
Well, I mean, this is a long, long time ago. This is probably like 4 or 5 years ago.
I'm sure he's looking at the price now going, oh my God.
I know. It's unbelievable. But and just an average guy, too. He's an analyst. He's a good guy. He's like, yeah, like speculative investments and stuff. But it is kind of amazing when you see what Bitcoin's doing right now.
Do you have any reason why that's happening? Can you pinpoint what? Well, the latest move, you know, you're talking about 5% or 8% moves on a daily basis. Now, by the way, just for everybody's knowledge, that is not normal for a quote unquote currency. Now, for investment, all right, have at it. Okay. But to even consider Bitcoin as a currency, something where you have in your pocket. Can you imagine if you have $100 in your pocket and it's going up and down 10% a day?
It is pretty crazy. And I'm not qualified enough to talk about Bitcoin, but I did have someone on my podcast, Wall Street Unplugged, probably about 9 months ago. And he actually convinced me enough to where I looked at Bitcoin and said, wow, this could be an amazing opportunity. I didn't buy it. I didn't know. I just started looking at it. But just the stuff that he was saying that it's so much a better alternative than gold, and you have all these gold bugs that are just going to destroy you when you say that. But he was dead right. I mean, there's a lot of professionals in this. There's other alternative cryptocurrencies that are going higher alongside it as well. Just be very, very careful because the fact that we're talking about this and it's everywhere and it's a top story. If you look on CNBC, where if you go on their app and look at their stories, it's a top story. That's usually a sign that you're pretty close to a top. And you don't want to short. You never, ever short anything.
Can you even short this? Can you even short this thing?
I don't know, but I'm sure.
I would not even get near there. I probably got some options.
I'm sure.
Let's follow up on some things you talked about some time ago. You know I like to bring this out and either rub your nose in it or pat your back, right?
Yep.
GE.
Rub my nose in it.
What's with GE?
What's going on? I said I was riding oil and GE has come off its highs. Guys, if I can give you advice, I would be a huge, huge aggressive buyer of GE right now, like huge buyer. It's going to be one of my largest holdings. I'm continuing to purchase it. And this is for some, look, it's not a trade. If you look at the charts, it's come down. I'm not talking about a trade. I'm talking about something that you're going to hold for 10 years. You're going to get paid a 3.5% yield. You have the top insiders in Milk buying right now. They're buying very, very aggressively, huge amounts. You just had Ray Dalio take a position last quarter on this pullback. If you're not familiar, Bridgewater Capital, biggest hedge fund in the world, best performing hedge fund in the world. This guy,
he's the Axe Capital
Capital without the
without any, the bullshit.
Yeah, without the BS and not any regulatory concerns, but. But right now, I think people just the concern with GE is last quarter they came out with cash flow that didn't meet estimates. And rightly so, people were concerned. But when you really dig down to the numbers, they don't have cash flow concerns. They're perfectly fine. They also have – they're sitting on $100 billion in cash overseas, which is – people fail to mention. But even with their cash flow, they're going to have plenty of cash flow to support their dividend. They're going to have plenty of cash flow to support their buybacks. They're probably aggressively buying back stocks now. I think it hit a bottom and it's up like a dollar off of it. But I think it's a fantastic opportunity. I mean, GE has a great growth profile. Again, the main concern is cash flow. But looking at GE is basically they're becoming
They're everything.
They're not only everything. They're energy. But one of the biggest things is the Brilliant Factory. So what they're doing is they have machines and factories learning from each other to get better using AI, big data, cloud. It's becoming a huge part of their business. Okay, now it's just not just machines and learning, but factories themselves and the fact that they have their hands on everything. This trend is a multi-trillion-dollar market. Okay, and it's not even in the first inning. They didn't even throw the first pitch yet. Okay, so this is a massive, massive growth model. So much where I think but Bridgewater Capital is another fund that was in it, but Natalia. But anyway,
well, let me ask you something. I need to ask something. We're going to go down a side street here. Mm-hmm. You have all this great AI. You have this wonderful business that's running on machines, robotics, automation. I'm talking about like factories and things of that nature, and manufacturing and distribution. Doesn't that bode very badly for the jobs market? I mean, I know there's a lot of, they'll be replaced by people building the technology. But if you really take it to its natural course, technology will build its own technology one day.
I just came back from visiting, this is about a few months ago, the Boeing's plant, right? Manufacturing
plant. Charleston?
In Everett. Oh. And this is Everett, Washington. It's the biggest building manufacturing plant in the world. So, I mean, they have a police department, a fire department. They have these massive doors. It's a 100-foot football field door, and they have five of them and on the front of the building. It is enormous. It's unbelievable. They have sleeping quarters. I've never seen anything like it. And you're seeing a lot of that where a lot of it's machines now. So, you know, it's all automated, and that's the field to get into if you want a job. I mean, start learning that technology if you're in college. Don't try to become a kindergarten teacher, grammar school teacher. I know so many. It's just there's so many people that want that job. It's so hard to get a job. But if you really want to focus on the growth opportunities, there it is. It's in technology. Start learning this stuff now. But you know they still will hire. I think it's 55,000 employees were in there, and a lot of it's already automated.
It's got its own zip code.
Oh man, you have no idea how big this building is. It's think of if you saw an assembly line at GM, but it's airplanes.
I was at the one recently. I was in Charleston, South Carolina. By the way, what a great town, Charleston, South Carolina. Have you been there?
I haven't been there.
You got to go there.
I know, it's not even that far from me.
I mean, it's really cool, Frank. It's got great food. It's got great atmosphere. It's very hip. Great. By the way, the breweries and the distilleries drinking the local whiskeys. That was awfully good. Not to mention the barbecue and the fried chicken. But
getting back to GE. Yeah, I want to finish my point on GE really quick.
Sorry. You start talking about food and whiskey, I go way off.
But with GE right here, one, you have the insiders buying. You have some of the largest hedge funds in the world buying. But you're looking at a massive, massive growth model that you transition their business. Huge growth expected. You're looking at a company that's not trading. It's not an expensive stock here if you're looking at forward earnings and you're getting a 3.5% yield. So, you know, GE at this level, I'd be an aggressive buy. If you're looking to hold the stock for 10 years, earn a great yield, you probably earn minimum 10-12% of your investment annually for the next 10 years.
Yeah. So, I mean, in terms of, that's a big conglomerate. And like you did say, that's a 3.5% dividend or so. So, I mean, obviously I could see that. What about, you know, you play around in some of the more, you go from GE, which is like, you know, the mom and pop stock, right? And Frank's talking, he's talking about GE. And then he's talking about a name. You're like, is that a stock? What is that? So give me a name of a stock that you've been kind of looking at these days, that nothing too crazy, but, and you know, maybe something in the technology area somewhere that you've kind of, or anywhere that you've been looking at.
Wow, that's a good question. So
Really hot on gold, and you're really hot on materials and mining and all that.
You know what? I'm not hot on gold. I like specific gold stocks, but I'm very, very particular because people just randomly buy these gold stocks and go crazy. But if you're going to speculate in the junior mining market, you got to buy companies with good management teams, good infrastructure. You got to make sure that they have enough cash, you know, to support their plans. I mean, guys, if you just think about this stat for a minute, I've said this and people get so pissed off because I speak at a lot of these gold conferences. One out of every 3,000 projects becomes a producing mine.
Yeah.
And I said, if you look at the companies here, and I think it was two, whatever, if they all had like 10 projects, whatever it was, I forgot when I did the math. I was like, one of these companies is going to have a producing mine, which means that probably more than 95% of these companies aren't going to exist 10 years from now. Yeah. So if you want to invest in gold and junior miners, just think about that mentality. It's like, you know, you're going to have good news. You could trade them. It's almost like, yeah, phase 1, phase 2, phase 3 data in biotechs. But, you know, with the, you know, it's based on drilling results. They're going to drill as much as they can. Their goal is, you know, to find a nice big pot of gold and basically high grade and sell it to the majors. But the majors aren't buying anything because they're still leveraged. So it's a very tough market. You got to be very select. But with that said, there's a lot of cool bargains in the space. Let me see if I can give you one. I would say gold mining, I think, is an amazing company. I mean, this is a company I followed for a while. It's GOLD.V, so it's on the Venture Exchange, or GLDLF. It's kind of small. This is a company run by Amir Adnani, a very close friend. It's been getting crushed. They have 25 million ounces of gold equivalent ounces. So what this guy did is raised a lot of money during the over the past 4 years and just bought up properties probably for pennies on a dollar, and he's sitting on a massive portfolio that's being valued at about $7-$8 of gold in the ground. If you want to put that in perspective, from 2012-2016, which is about 60 transactions, the average price paid in an acquisition is about $70. This is trading for $7. Wow. So it's an amazing company run by an amazing team. They're expanding now. It used to be called Brazil Resources, but they expanded out, so they changed their name recently because and this is like 6 months ago, because they have property in Colombia now and in Canada. So it's just, they're doing all the right things, but they're in the wrong market, which is, you know, gold's terrible. It's getting crushed to stock. But I think it's an amazing opportunity. It's a company you could buy, close your eyes, and in 5 years, I can't see this company not get 25 million ounces, guys. You have no idea how many ounces. That's a huge amount being valued at $7 per ounce. So I really like this company here.
Let me just finish up with this question. Retailers. Now, retailers have been crushed depending on what side of the retail game that you're on, right? So if you're – let me just pick some. Let me think. If you're Amazon, for example, you're doing fine. Okay. If you're some of these, you know, other retailers, you're not doing so fine. A lot of people are talking about the Amazon effect and the web finally kicking in. But you look at these big box retailers like the Macy's, the Kohl's, the Dillard's, the Sears, the JCPenney's, you know, name all of these. Plus the second tier ones like the Abercrombie's, I mean, they're just getting killed. Is there opportunity here?
I think there's an opportunity. I don't think big box is dead, right? I mean, you saw Best Buy blow out the numbers, Walmart, which is up.
But let's just also say there's major short interest on some of these names. So the first day pop or 3 day pop. I mean, yeah. Best Buy has no competition anymore. H.H. Gregg is out of business.
Exactly.
They have more
and
competition.
That's the thing. Exactly. And you're looking at Walmart. Walmart was solid. Everyone else was terrible, like you said, right? I'm just pointing out a couple of, you know, cherry picking a couple names that are good, because there is a mix that companies need to figure out between online and in-store, which most haven't yet. And the fact that the rumors are Amazon wants to become a big box retailer and open up several stores shows that there's a mix companies need to figure out, which is weird, right? Because you're like, wow, Amazon's killing it. They want to have that opportunity where people could go to the store or order online and go and pick up, because that's a great model that works. But unfortunately, these companies are having trouble finding out what that mix is. Mm-hmm. But, you know, one of the stocks I like here is Target. Target fell tremendously, over 4% yield, almost 4.5% yield, trading at 13 times forward earnings. And they're not linked. All those companies you mentioned have one thing in common. They have a lot of exposure to apparel, and apparel's been getting destroyed.
Yeah.
Where Target has, you know, again, anyone's been a Target, you know, they sell much more than apparel. So you're getting paid 4.3% to wait. They're going to turn around just like Walmart. It was 2015 got smoked, right? Worst performing. Just like Apple got smoked. It was trading in the mid-90s. Target's a great brand, a great company. I think at this price, trading where it is, you know, falling alongside everyone else. Again, I'd be worried about companies that have large exposure to apparel. Those are the ones that are getting smoked. They can't seem to time it right in terms of, you know, what to put in their stores. I went to a Dick's Sporting Goods. And I live in Northern Florida, and they had no discounts. And half of the material in the Dick's Sporting Goods section, which was Under Armour and stuff, was long sleeve. Hmm. And it's like 85 degrees here. And they didn't have discounts on it. So what happens? Dick's Sporting Goods came out, and they reported a terrible quarter. I was like, wow, what a surprise. You know, but when you look at Dick's Sporting Goods and what they're selling, and you know, when you're heavily into apparel, you really, really have to watch out. But I like Target. I don't think big box is dead. I think you need to see a lot of store closures. I just don't think you got to be careful when you say something's completely dead, because
I don't think it's completely dead. Although,
you didn't say that, but
they're hanging. Some of these guys like a JCPenney and Sears are hanging on just a final level of inhalation from their oxygen. You know, the other ones like Macy's has some room to run. They have a good online presence. You know, but there's a
apparel.
A lot of the same crap over and over and over. And
Nordstrom got killed.
I always say I don't remember the last time I've stepped into any of these stores. The only reason why I go to Best Buy is I want to like maybe see the differential from something, and then I price check it on it. And fortunately, these days, which Best Buy did, this is why they're able to compete, because they will match prices. In the old days, I would just buy it somewhere else online or whatever. Now they'll match prices. Just say, hey, look at that right there. Just match it. Okay, we'll give you that price. I'm like, okay, thanks.
I know.
And that's
tough for retailers too, because it's really, you know, now what's a competitive advantage? Now, if you're going into stores, now it has to deal with location. You know, where are you going? Where are you going to get the most traffic? Because, you know, if you're really going to compete and everyone has the same price, it's more about more people getting into your store. So, right. You know, it's a tough industry. I think there is opportunity there. I wouldn't be going out and buying anything, but, you know, I would stay with the big guys who've gotten hit. Maybe even Nike's okay, which again, Nike's into apparel, but you know, I think they've gotten hit enough where they have a good dividend, and those guys usually always get it right, have a great international presence. And like I said earlier, international sales are really going through the roof for most companies that have that exposure in the S&P 500.
Well, if you like what you hear from Frank, or even if you didn't like what you hear from Frank, because maybe he talks so fast, you got to put this on slower.
Try to get everything
put
in.
On, put on slow. Put the, you're able to do that on this, just to put it at half speed. You can go over to frankcurzio.com. Where else can we go?
You go to frankcurzio.com. You'll have access to my podcast. You can go Wall Street Unplugged, which is my podcast, and Curzio Research, where we have two newsletters now. I opened up my own company recently. That's actually starting to really do very well, and very happy to actually stop making everybody else money and working for other other newsletter companies. So
good for you.
And it's nice being able to say whatever you want, which is, you know, again, really kind of, and you don't have to, you know, again, everything's your ideas and what you're doing. And so far it's been doing very well for us. So I appreciate you giving me the chance to explain that.
Well, we'll have more information on thedisciplinedinvestor.com under the show notes here for Frank Curzio. If you want to listen to more of Frank Curzio, by the way, you can listen to Wall Street Unplugged, but you could also go on The Disciplined Investor and on the podcast button, you just click the top there. All you do is just type in his name when it comes up, and you'll see all the shows, and there's a lot of them that Frank has appeared on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. But I encourage you, and I strongly encourage you, Frank has some great newsletters and great ideas that come out. It's not that expensive, to be honest with you, to get on his newsletter. So you can probably get some freebies there. I'll send you over to frankcurzio.com to check it all out. Frank, best to your family.
Thanks. You too, buddy. I really appreciate you asking me to come back on.
All right. We'll talk soon. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Well, another great discussion wraps up with Frank Curzio. Like I said, go check out all that he has to offer over on frankcurzio.com. Make sure to follow me on Twitter at Andrew Horowitz. That's one word. And of course, Investology. We're going to be starting the second stage of the beta trial very soon. And you can get yourself on the list to find out when it's available over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Just click on the Investology area or check out the show notes for this. There's a little form in there you can fill out, and we'll put you on the list for those that are going to be getting in first to the new Investology program that we are offering, the investment program, which, as we call it, is advisor crafted and technology enhanced. Thanks again for joining me. I'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.